Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness, and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Endurance Experience. And we have arrived at the end of season 3, just like that. Wow, it's been an unbelievable season 3. And now that we are at the end of season 3, you know what that means. We have arrived at the best of episode. I really like doing the best of episode. And for those of you that are newer to the Endurance Experience, I take a dive into the podcast statistics and pull out the 5 most downloaded and played podcasts of the season and pull out a clip, review the clip, do some updated commentary on that podcast episode. And it makes for a very interesting best of episode. And for those people that are newer, you get a sampling of what the podcast is about, and it really helps me figure out what do people really want to listen to. And I use that for planning purposes for the next season. The tagline of the Endurance Experience has always been the intersection of endurance, sport, health, fitness, and life. And that's certainly was the case with this last season. Given everything that has happened with the global pandemic, I was fortunate enough to get some unbelievable podcast guests. And for those of you that do podcasts, you know that it's sort of a challenge to get people to sit down with you. You're really at the mercy and whim of people to get them to come to a podcast with you. There's really no incentive for someone to give you 40 minutes, 60 minutes of their time. And so I am very grateful for the people that agreed to come on the podcast for season 3. So the top 5 of season 3, and this is in the order that they occurred. Episode 21, Meb Kifleski, 4-time Olympian and silver medalist. So that was absolutely a great podcast. Episode 23, Dr. Corey Hebert, the doctor of the people. Unbelievable podcast there. He has a big platform, often tapped to talk on national and international news. So I can see why that one was very popular. Episode 26, Dr. Michelle Cardell. She is a nutrition and obesity scientist. Amazing podcast and an amazing woman. Those last 2 podcast guests covering some very important issues with perspectives from one, a doctor, a medical doctor, Corey Hebert, and then Dr. Cardell, a PhD in obesity science, nutrition science, and registered dietitian. And so one black, one Latina, both covering the very important and complicated issues with the social determinants of health, disproportionate access of populations to health care, and other issues related to nutrition, obesity, and COVID and the impacts. Let's see, episode 27, Chloe McArdle. She is the English Channel swim world record holder. And that got a lot of movement in the open water swimming and generally the swimming community. And the fifth, Dr. Alan Lim. He's a sports physiologist, sports nutritionist, and pro cycling coach. And so you see a good mix between sport, endurance sport, and sort of health and nutrition podcasts. So I'll go through a clip of each one, and you want to stay tuned to the end too, because I want to talk about what you can expect from season 4 and some of the new ideas I have for the podcast. All right, here is the first clip. I'll set it up. Meb Keflezighi, 4-time Olympian, Olympian silver medalist, the only runner to win the New York City Marathon, Boston Marathon, and have an Olympic medal. So in a time of civil unrest, Meb is giving his perspective on the power of sport to be a unifying force.
I am a Nelson Mandela's believer, and his quote was, I think he said, sports unites us more than anything else does. Yeah. And the power of sports is amazing. I think being a distance runner or being in sports, it allows you to be family in a way that, hey, you play rugby or you play a 5K, you're a pole vaulter or you are this, or you're a sprinter, you have this common togetherness.
Yeah.
And no matter what race you are a teammate. And I got your back no matter what. And I think, over the years, I think, running has been majority of white or Caucasian. But over the years, there also has been increase in African-Americans, Latinos, yeah, Indian, and Asian, and things like that. And it's a beautiful thing because, we don't know what their religion is. We don't know what their background look like. But we know that everybody wants to run 5K,
yes,
10, 13.1 miles, or 26, or ultra. And it's like, oh, I missed out this. I wish, in the distance running, you always say, I wish I started early. There's never been a person that says, why am I here? It's like, oh, man, this is such a beautiful thing. And I think hopefully that's what it is. I think, we can educate our brothers and sisters more so, because I think, when people think of distance running, it is used as a punishment in high school. Hey, you're late, going to give me push-ups and runs. But eventually with a 5K, 10K, you don't have to sprint. You just got to go at your pace and make it enjoyable and have music and all those things to help you be the best that you can. And, make it flawless versus, oh, I got to go run again. Dread it. It's not that bad. You will get better over time and the friendship that you make. And, there's good cops. There's bad cops.
Yeah.
Mainly there's more good cops. There's good white people. There's some, unfortunately, not so good people. But my career, my thing has been, when I told you earlier about UCLA, there was a professor, Ted, I believe he was named Ted, and he always says, once you run for the citizen of the world, this is in 98, he says, Meb, you have a unique way coming from Africa to Italy to United States. You represent a citizen of the world. And, I wish I had listened to him. I think there was a flag that I would have done it. But I think it's something to say that people help you build up to be the best you can. And I have people who are Caucasian who left their keys in a hiding spot. Say, Meb, you know what? When you come, you're traveling. Here's the key to the house. Or here's the combination for the lock, for the alarm of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because once you judge that person by their character, skin is just 11. I love what Ben Carson said. When you go to a surgery, you just want to save life no matter what that person is. When you go under the skin, it's all blood. It's red.
Right.
It doesn't say, I'm Republican, I'm Democrat, I am, my economic status is this or why not. It's just pure, your instinct will say, I got to save that person. And for us as runners, it's like, hey, follow marathoner, hey, follow a half miler, a half marathoner, or follow runner versus, oh, because you are this and that.
If you haven't listened to that podcast, I highly recommend going back and listening to that. We have a great conversation about Meb's life, coming from war-torn Eritrea. So Eritrea is essentially adjacent to Ethiopia. They were in a war for many years. And he came from war-torn Eritrea. And him and his family didn't speak much English. And managed to surpass obstacles and come over to America and get into UCLA. And I was very proud of that accomplishment of getting into UCLA, competing at UCLA. And obviously we know the end of the story. He rose up to become one of the greatest American runners of all time. And probably on the Mount Rushmore of American runners. On that podcast, we talk about Meb's latest book, 26 Marathons, where he has a story for each one of the 26 marathons, professional marathons that he ran. And even the ones he didn't win or the one he did not finish, he tells a story behind the marathon and then relates it to a real world theme. And fantastic book. I read it in one day. I highly recommend it. In that particular clip, he's talking about civil unrest that was occurring at the time we recorded that. And that was sometime in the spring, I believe. And this was before the summer when the civil unrest had boiled over worldwide. And he talked about Nelson Mandela and how Nelson Mandela felt about the power of sport as a unifying force. And I talk about that on the podcast, about how Nelson Mandela used sport to help unify South Africa. And so it's an amazing clip because he ties in his life coming over to America, going to UCLA, being a runner, having to deal with good people, bad people of all stripes. And he even on the podcast talks about a negative situation that occurred with law enforcement when he was running. And so he was able to tie in a lot of what was happening at the time, the civil unrest, and much of it is still applicable. And the underlying theme there being, look, sport is probably the one thing that unites everyone. Where we're playing a sport, we're competing together, we're training together. Nobody really cares about who you are, what your background is, what your political affiliation is. Most of the time, they don't care about that. And, you know, we're just competing and we're pushing each other and enjoying the sport and having fun. And so that was the message of that clip. In other words, there's always going to be obstacles in life. There's always going to be people who don't like you for some reason or another. Whether they don't like the way you look, they don't like your skin tone, they don't like the way you dress, your eyes, your nose, your hair, whatever. But I think what Meb has showed us is that in the end of the day, you still have to do the best that you can. Lace up your shoes, run as hard as you can, train as hard as you can. Try to avoid the people that would try to tear you down. Build alliances and trust with those people that build you up. Athlete psychology is one of those key pillars of performance when we coaches train and coach athletes for competition. And I started using a rubric called the 4 C's of optimal performance, which I didn't make up, but a coach taught it to me, and I thought it was a pretty solid rubric to train an athlete in athlete psychology. The four C's: confidence, composure, commitment, and concentration. And as long as you keep your eyes on those four C's in sport, it will take you a long way. And there's sort of a parallel there to real life. I come to realize, I said, wow, these four C's really align well with what you need to do in real life. And I think you'll find that, just like Meb found out, that irrespective of what's happening around you with people, as long as you keep your eyes straight and you keep your eyes on the target, this is not a thing that anyone can do to stop you. And obstacles may get thrown your way, but I guarantee you, you'll find ways around them, over them, under them, or through them. Training for endurance sports has a way of rewiring your brain to these facts. So remember them. And make sure you go follow Meb on Twitter at RunMeb. And he doesn't just post about sport. He's not afraid to get in there and talk about the, you know, political or social issues that are moving society. All right, let's set up the next clip. Dr. Corey Hebert. This was a great podcast and it was a fun podcast. I highly recommend you go out and follow him on his social media channels. He's got over probably 100,000 followers across all his platforms. He's one of those doctors that have a public profile that tells it like it is. And he doesn't mince words, and that's why I like him. And so we talk about COVID-19. This was before the vaccines were ready. We talked a lot about COVID, the vaccines, and we talked about the conspiracy theories that are out there and why they're out there. But the clip that I chose is one related to health, fitness, and nutrition, and his take coming from the perspective of a medical doctor. As a physician, what would you say to those who are advocating that we should not shine a light on the obesity epidemic because it sort of makes a certain segment of the population feel uncomfortable by talking about these issues?
Well, I will tell you this. The time for not doing things because people are uncomfortable about the truth is past. Mm-hmm. We're going to lose another generation of black people because people don't want to think things are uncomfortable. It's time to be uncomfortable when it comes to health. It's time to be uncomfortable when it comes to anything that's not right. Right? Black people are way overweight. White people are too, but black people tend to be overweight. There's a way to do it appropriately because nobody wants to fat shame people.
Right.
But the problem is that, I'll put it like this. You've seen some of my things on Facebook, and I had this thing called the Angriest Doctor where you kind of yell at people, and it's kind of funny. I make jokes about it. But, you know, every now and then I get someone to say, we don't like that you're yelling at us. We don't accept that. When people talk to us that way. And those are the people that I couldn't get them to trust. Okay? They couldn't trust. Because when your grandmother told you, don't go outside, and she yelled at you, you might have been upset, but you didn't go outside. Because you trusted that she was telling you the truth. But if your friend told you to not go outside and yelled at you, you'd feel a little different. Because what does your friend know? Your friend don't know anything. You know what I'm saying? So you don't trust them, so you don't like it when that happens. So the concept of having to be uncomfortable, to me, is based in trust.
Mm-hmm.
when my patient trusts me, I can make them uncomfortable when they know what they're doing is wrong, right? You know, they're uncomfortable if they don't believe what I'm telling them. So my point is, I'm over being uncomfortable, but I am over being empathetic. Not over being empathetic, because you have to be empathetic, because once again, it's right back to the social determinants of health. Can't call somebody fat and tell them to quit eating bad things when they can't eat good things, right? So it's a very, it's a delicate balance. But what we have to remember is that black people, we eat bad food. No, a couple of reasons. We eat bad food that's starchy and bad because that's our slave diet. That's what we grew up on. That's what we know. You know, you couldn't work in the fields all day if you had kale and lean salmon.
Right.
Yeah. Okay? You couldn't, because you need carbohydrates to work in the fields. Okay? Black people, they didn't have a lot of fat slaves that worked in the fields because they burned off all the carbohydrates that they ate, you know, with all the bread and all the pasta, well, not pasta, but all the bread and all the rice, all that, all the sugar that we ate. So, you know, we have to kind of come to grips with that. That is in us to want that. And also, it's comfort food. Our brain needs glucose. Our brain needs sugar to operate. So if we're upset, you know, either you got your fix, either you're salty or sugar, right? If you're really upset, just eat some ice cream if you're a sugar person. You'll feel a lot better. It gives you some euphoria. It makes your brain. If you're a person that has, and you like salty, eat a bag of Doritos. Doritos isn't paying me for this. All right. you know, it makes you feel better. That's why when people are depressed, they eat. They gain a bunch of weight. After Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, everybody gained 15 pounds because you didn't know if you had a house or not, right? So these things, we have to address that emotional eating. And then we have to give people the information. Because most people don't understand that a bowl of rice has twice as much sugar as a bowl of ice cream.
Yep.
So you try to lose weight, you're like, you don't get it.
Yep.
You just don't understand. Nobody ever told you that. You know, you go and have you go out and work out for 30 minutes walking around a track with your friends, okay? You might burn 100 calories doing that. You're not burning any calories walking around a track without being in a very brisk walk. And then you go get a smoothie.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? So yeah. You're done. So I just kind of want to throw people out some of these data points. Being waking up as a human being, just being awake in a day and just doing your regular walking around, you know, no big deal, you're going to burn about 1,500 calories.
Yeah.
Okay? So that means for you not to gain weight, you can only eat 1,500 calories. You're in stasis. You're in homeostasis, right? So, but if you eat more than 1,500 calories, and you wonder why the American Diabetic Association, their diet is a 1,500 calorie diet, right? Makes sense, right?
Right.
If you eat more than 1,500 calories, that's the amount of calories you got to burn off for you not to gain weight. Now, let's talk about if you work out hard for about an hour, you probably burn about 500 calories, 600 calories. So that means that if you work out hard and you just get up and be your normal person and you work out an hour a day, that means that you can eat 2,100 calories, because that's about 600 calories that you got negative. Eat about 2,100 calories a day and you won't gain any weight. But if you go to Outback Steakhouse and eat one meal, that's 3,000 calories.
Right. Yeah.
And if you go to a bar and drink a pina colada, frozen pina colada, that's 1,500 calories right there. So that's why your high school pictures look different than your pictures now.
Right. Yeah. Ready? Is this energy balance equation, what I found is that people systematically have a lack of knowledge of that, exactly what you're saying. And also, you know, there is the challenge that eating healthy is not cheap. In some communities that are disadvantaged communities, they just can't just go to Whole Foods and get healthy food.
You mean whole paycheck?
Yeah, whole paycheck, right. Exactly. And so fast food and other types of food is quicker and cheaper and things like that. And so that...
Think about this. If you go to Whole Foods and get two bunches of broccoli, that could be $6, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Burger King and get six hamburgers for $6.
Right.
Do the math on that, you know?
Yeah. And so all of this is part of that robust... solution that we need, communication, education, changes to structural issues. All of it is a, it's a robust solution that's needed. That's Dr. Corey A. Baird. Definitely go back and check out that podcast. He's on Twitter as Dr. C. Hebert, H-E-B-E-R-T, W-D-S-U. Check him out, and check out his Facebook page, too. He's constantly on the news. He's on a panel. He's posting. He's live streaming. He's very active. Check him out. But I remember we had the conversation when the vaccines were being talked about, and he's deeply involved. He knows Dr. Fauci personally. Often, I think he mentioned on that podcast that he was in communication with him. He's deeply involved in the research. And so I'm recording this on February 1st, and this is the one-year anniversary to the day when we found out about the first United States case of COVID-19. And I remember this time last year, this was at the crescendo where everything turned over in almost overnight. It was sometime in February that everything shut down, February of last year. It's pretty amazing. But we talked a lot about COVID-19 on that podcast. We talked a lot about vaccination. We talked a lot about the conspiracy theory and the reason why there's distrust among the black community and communities of color, why there's distrust for science, distrust of medicine. So that was all very interesting. And if you're keeping score, now after a year, we now have vaccines going into people's arms right now. And so I talked about previous podcasts how that was just really a remarkable achievement of science. And then, you know, remember on that podcast, Dr. Hebert talked about how, you know, sometimes we have to take a look at all of the factors that are involved in the process. And so we will continue to look at things like science, the rollout, how effective the vaccines are. We'll continue to analyze the data as the data come in. But if you're keeping score, as of today, it looks like Bloomberg is reporting that over 30 million Americans have received at least one dose of the vaccine, one of the vaccines. And worldwide is look like it's approaching 100 million people worldwide. So that's pretty remarkable. We'll have to continue to watch Dr. Corey A. Baird's channels to get all of the latest information, research, and data. And, you know, perhaps we can get him back on the podcast someday to have him explain some of it to us. So this clip is on the obesity epidemic, and I wanted to get the perspective of a medical doctor, right? Because you go into a medical doctor, the doctors are the ones that says, listen, you're at risk and you may need to make lifestyle changes, but also keeping in mind that it's extremely complicated, especially when you're dealing with communities that have disproportionate access to healthcare, to healthy food, and so on. I think it's important to point out in that clip that Dr. Hebert, as a medical doctor, recognizes the global obesity epidemic as a problem and recognizes the risks borne by clinical obesity. And it's particularly important to hear Dr. Hebert's sentiment as a black physician on our method of approach and tactics, given we're seeing so many deaths in our community, the black community. Before I comment any further on this topic. Perhaps I should just set up the next clip, which is with Dr. Michelle Cardell from episode 26. She's a PhD, an obesity scientist, and a nutrition scientist. She also is a registered dietitian. She studies the effects of obesity, and she's also a Latina woman. So she has a very important and valuable perspective given her field of study and her understanding of disparities and the reason why such disparities exist. Listen to this clip.
So to start off with the definition of obesity, so when we're talking about a population level, what we use is something called body mass index. And what it does is it's a ratio of your weight to your height. And if that number is a 30 or above, then you would be medically classified at a population level with obesity. So BMI works generally pretty good at a population level, but it is a horrific indicator of both obesity as well as health on an individual level. And so in order to determine obesity at an individual level, in an ideal situation, we're going to be doing a lot more testing. We're going to be doing things like measuring your body fat, if that's possible. And we're going to be taking a very patient-centered approach. Some patients are not interested in discussing their weight, and that is absolutely something that needs to be respected. And so I'm very careful with patients to say, A, is this something that you're interested in discussing? And B, what is the terminology that you feel most comfortable for me to utilize? There's a lot of consent that needs to be involved in discussing this incredibly vulnerable topic. And in terms of the evidence, there's a great body of literature characterizing the relationships between excess adiposity, which is really what we're talking about here. We're talking about excess levels of adipose tissue or fat. And that's why we need to go beyond this measure of BMI when really diagnosing obesity. But the relationship between excess levels of adipose tissue or body fat are associated with a variety of adverse medical complications as well as psychological outcomes. So things like increased risk for heart disease, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Then also, it's important to note that obesity can also result in discrimination and stigmatization and bullying, and that these experiences, of course, can lead to depression, anxiety, and a variety of other psychological factors. And so it's important to note that the ramifications from obesity can be both physiological in nature, but also psychological in nature from the extreme weight stigma and discrimination that individuals with obesity experience across their life course.
Okay, so to summarize, BMI is appropriate as a screening tool for a normally distributed population. You have to drill down deeper with someone to get a very full understanding of the clinical diagnosis. Is that a good summary of what you stated there?
Absolutely. My first visit with a patient, I usually spend at least 60 minutes with them diving deep into their medical history, their social history, doing a variety of assessments before any sort of diagnosis of obesity would be made.
That's important, what you just stated there, because I think there is a great deal of confusion about this in today's environment. When you hear statements that you can be health, quote unquote, healthy at any size, and then there's movements coming from various groups that they call them body positive, healthy at any size, and there's a narrative that we should be okay with obesity. And I wonder, from a scientist or a dietitian,
How do you feel about some of these growing movements?
So I think the Health at Every Size movement is probably the one that has taken on has the most influence,
mm-hmm.
and it's only getting bigger. And I would say that I agree with the majority of the components that come out of the Health at Every Size movement,
mm-hmm.
focused on the significant problem of weight stigma and discrimination, where I diverge from what Hayes advocates, and you can find this in their fact sheet, is that the idea that obesity is in and of itself not harmful for health. And I would strongly argue that the data is very clear. I mean, how do we explain something like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease if excess adiposity is not in and of itself a predictor of adverse health outcomes? What is challenging, and that I think is a fair point that's brought up, is that it's very difficult to disentangle the effects of weight stigma and discrimination from that of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true. What I can see, and what the data does show, we have a really interesting study under review right now, where we see that there's two different components. One is that the 3-5% body weight loss reduces cardiometabolic risk factors. And that can be in individuals still maintaining what would be considered to be obesity, but that 3-5% reduction in body weight loss already improves cardiometabolic outcomes. In a paper that we have under review right now, we actually looked at nationally representative data in individuals who had undergone bariatric surgery. And those individuals who had undergone bariatric surgery, despite significant amounts of weight, their medical classification, their BMI still was elevated over a BMI of 30. Yet their cardiometabolic parameters paralleled those of individuals who had not experienced obesity and were medically classified in the healthy weight category.
Mm-hmm.
Do know that medical intervention, such as bariatric surgery, can be an extremely promising and effective treatment for individuals with obesity. Clearly, it's not for everyone, but we do have some excellent evidence-based treatments available.
I see. And cancers, what does the latest research, if you know about it, say about the correlation with some cancers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've seen studies, and cancer is certainly not my area, so I don't want to speak outside of my lane, but we do know that obesity is related to the prevalence of a variety of different cancers.
She is on Twitter as her name, Michelle Cardell. She's also on Facebook. You can find her there, and also Instagram. I received so many positive comments on that podcast. The nutrition podcasts, I realize, go over very well with the endurance experience listener base. You guys love the nutrition podcasts. So not surprisingly, it was among the top most downloaded. So you have to go on and listen to that podcast if you haven't. It's very eye-opening. Every time I have a chance to talk to PhD, somebody who spends their life researching an entire topic, it allows me to look at the issue in ways that I never thought to see it. She talks about how obesity impacts populations differently, and that was very eye-opening. She talked about the impact of obesity stigma. We also did a little bit of nutrition myth busting. That was fun. And we also talked about an issue that she has been passionate about, which is the lack of diversity in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. And disparities in STEM. Playing those two clips back to back really set the entire picture. One, a medical doctor, the other, a PhD and registered dietitian, both people of color. And while their tactics may vary, the sentiments of those professionals are pretty much in lockstep with science, epidemiology, medicine, and just about every major World Health Organization position statement. Anyone listening to this podcast, all you need do is take a look at the explanations and position statements coming out of the American Medical Association, the Center for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, the Harvard School of Public Health, all of the research coming out of the National Institute of Health, and even the American Cancer Society. Take a look at all of the position statements from all of the World Health Organizations, and you will see that they are all clear on what the preponderance of the empirical evidence says, which is exactly what you heard from these two professionals on their podcasts. So when you see factions from regions of the internet claiming that you can be healthy at any size, obesity is not a problem, we shouldn't be talking about it because it makes people feel uncomfortable, moving against the mountains of empirical evidence and epidemiology findings. Number one, that should be a signal to you that those individuals have confused the difference between what's true and what they may want to be true. And second, you have to understand, to promote that information that's counter to all of the World Health Organizations, that's very serious. If you look at COVID-19, this was a real-world stress test, and COVID-19 has exposed the obesity epidemic in real time. Okay, we've seen the data is still coming in. We still need to analyze it. We still need to understand the mechanisms. But we've seen higher hospitalization rates and higher mortality rates in obese populations. That's a serious thing. A virus doesn't care one iota what you wish to be true. A virus doesn't care about who you vote for. The virus doesn't care about what your skin pigmentation is. And a virus doesn't care how you came to be in the health condition that you're in. It just doesn't care. And so that's what we have to understand here. And when this is all said and done, all of those people that have promoted these narratives that run counter to every World Health Organization and cancer organization, they are going to have to reckon with all of the misleading and potentially harmful information that has been propagated under the guise of, let's first decide what we wish to be true and then reverse engineer the facts that hold up those beliefs, even if they run counter to all of the evidence. Now, I used to say, you know, those folks that are propagating this information, look, their hearts are in the right place. And I stopped saying that because even though there may be, quote unquote, good intention behind what they're doing, the ramifications of what they're doing are just too serious if they're ultimately seducing people down a pathway that could be ultimately counterproductive to health. It's possible to have two thoughts in your mind at the same time. It's possible to be completely empathetic, supportive, and kind, and also be truthful about the seriousness of the facts. And yeah, these researchers, you heard both of them explain that, right? Support, empathy, kindness always has to accompany any approach we take. Remember, be skeptical of anyone that makes claims not backed by empirical evidence or makes claims that runs counter to all of the empirical evidence. Transitioning to the second to last clip, that was episode 27 with Chloe McArdle. She is an ultra marathon swimmer and one of the greatest marathon swimmers of all time, male or female. She swims the English Channel. And for those who don't know about that, if you didn't listen to that podcast, that's a 21-mile swim. And she's done it 37 times. She's even done it 3 times in a week. She also holds the record for the longest unassisted swim, 77 miles long, taking her over 40 hours to complete. Phenomenal. So she talks about that swim in this clip, the logistics of pulling off that swim over 40 hours and the effect that it had on her. And she talks about the constant pull endurance athletes have to do something bigger and bigger and how she deals with that pull and what we can expect from her in the future. Explain to our listeners how you pulled that off logistically.
It was a big challenge. So we had moving elements. So when I was with my ex-husband, this is years ago now, back in 2014, we had so many elements to manage. We were running things on a shoestring budget. I still run all my marathon swims on tiny, tiny budgets. So I was managing most of the logistics, which was challenging because I was also the marathon swimmer myself. But leading into that swim, I recruited a team of shark protection people to keep sharks at bay. So we had specific strategies to deter sharks from being in the vicinity of where I was swimming. So I had a whole team doing that. We had a team of kayakers on rotation so that I could always have 2 kayaks next to me because they were part of the strategy of keeping sharks away. Then we had 2 boats, so we needed drivers to drive those boats. And then we needed observers, so we needed 2 observers so they could rotate so there was an official ratified swim. Feeders for me. Then there was 2 people dedicated to just feeding me and then helping just run the logistics of things. So I had to recruit all those people. I had to organize their movements. Most of them were based in America. I live in Australia. So there was, you know, travel issues, more logistics, timing, schedules, and then also trying to find the right people, especially because a lot of the roles were volunteer. So I had to really work with other people's schedules and what they could offer because I was just so grateful to have their support. So logistically, yeah, it was a big, big event. But we pulled it off. It was, you know, it was just, it was incredible that everything worked so well. We had a few challenges along the way, but the group dynamic was that people had different strengths that they could offer at different times. And then when we did have challenges along the way, they worked things out and then they didn't need to get me involved in the challenges. They just sorted that out and really supported me on those boats so that I could focus on my job of literally just putting one arm in front of another until I hit land.
Wow. Man, there's so many questions that it would take another podcast to get through all of them.
But would.
You never felt sleepy. So that took what, 40 over 40 hours?
Yeah, 41 and a half hours.
Never got sleepy or anything?
No, I never got sleepy. So I'm constantly taking caffeine during these swims.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly moving. Now, I'm not sure from a physiological point of view, maybe you've got some ideas about how constant exercise delays the feeling of needing to sleep. There's something behind that. But what I did get was not just fatigue from exercising nonstop, an exhaustion from I was getting burned, like sunburned from the sun for 2 days nonstop. So I had, when I was getting stung by jellyfish, that was I was being poisoned as well as right. I was doing this. So on top of those things, I had the element of, because I couldn't sleep and my body couldn't recover and have any downtime, there was no off switch. Like, I was never allowed right. to get on the boat. I was never allowed to hang on to a kayak and rest. So not having the ability to let my body sleep meant that my fatigue increased, my exhaustion increased. And so instead of sleeping, my body just went a bit crazy and my mind lost the plot sometimes. For example, I started seeing letters come up, so imprint into the sand in front of me, just random chaotic letters. And when I first started my hallucinations in long distance swimming, which was in my first big marathon swim in the English Channel, which was 2009, that used to freak me out. To think that my mind was doing something that I couldn't understand, that I thought was real, was a scary thing. But by 2014, I was so used to it and I was comfortable with it. I said to myself, you know, I'm not, you know, this is happening. I don't want it to happen. But you know what? It's going to happen anyway. Let's have some fun. So I tried to actually make words in the sand through my hallucinations. Wow. I tried to just have a bit of fun with it and tried to start creating words. But I couldn't get to the point where I'm able to control my hallucinations.
Now, what about your kick? Were you doing a regular, you know, 2-beat kick, 4-beat kick, or were you not kicking much to conserve energy? What was the kick? Your kick like through this whole thing?
I'll send you some footage, some broadcast footage that went to TV as a link later. So just in case viewers want to see parts of this swim unfold, and you'll see that I maintained a 6-beat kick the whole entire swim.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. For those that watch my English Channel swims, even my multiple crossings, you'll see I just keep kicking the whole way. It's automatic for me now. I don't think to do a 6-beat kick. I only have one type of kick. Either kick or not kick.
Yeah, to put that into perspective for people listening, pool swimmers will do that for, you know, maybe 100 meters, 200 meters, something like that. So to maintain that for that long, that's incredible. That's incredible. Wow.
It's actually a disadvantage for me because, you know, legs have your biggest muscles in your body. Now, if I'm continuing to kick, then I'm burning heaps of oxygen.
Yeah.
But your legs actually aren't a main driver for moving forward. So I'm sending a lot of oxygen to my legs and I'm not even moving forward really for that effort. So, you know, it would have been better for me in my development as a marathon swimmer that I'd had a coach who said, look, if you're going to get into this marathon swimming, we need to have a look about adjusting your kick. But I never had that advice. I did, but it was very late in my marathon swimming career, you know, only about 3-4 years ago. And I haven't managed to adjust my stroke yet to go down to a 2-beat kick, which would be a little bit more better. Because in marathon swimming, all the kick you need is just to keep your legs up, your hips up to the surface. So that helps keep your legs up to the surface to maintain a good body position, so that you're reducing any frontal resistance and drag.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, you're not really getting much assistance. I mean, if you want to race a marathon and you want to get the fastest time that you can do, or put yourself in the best position to place well, you know, and think of it as a competitive strategy, then yeah, kicking is great, but you would only do a 6-beat kick at the back end of the swim, not the whole way through, like the Olympic marathon swimmers do in the 10K.
Yeah.
So yeah, look, it's not actually a great thing. I don't encourage others to do it because it's just not an efficient use of oxygen.
Yeah. And the same thing, triathlon, Ironman swimmers that we tell, you know, 2-beat kick. And, you know, sometimes you see swimmers not kicking at all. So that is, that's incredible. There's so much more that I could ask you about that, but that is an incredible feat. And that landed you a world record. That's unbelievable. Now, do you feel you've accomplished everything you can in marathon swimming, or do you feel a constant gravitational pull towards another bigger endeavor?
Yeah, so interesting you say that. It's a trap, I think, that endurance athletes or even elite athletes can get into, where they have this goal and it's a huge goal, and then they get to that goal and they're just constantly setting goals in the future. And I think that you've got to be careful as an athlete or even just high performing people generally, you've got to be careful, because if you fall into that trap where you've constantly always got bigger goals, then the only way for you to finish this whatever endeavor you're taking is for you either to die, become so injured that you can no longer perform, or overwork yourself that you get to the point of exhaustion, or mentally burn out, or you burn out all the important relationships in work and all your personal life. So I did have some really good advice a few years ago where one of my mentors said to me, you need to control your end game. You can't just constantly keep pushing yourself and putting yourself out there, because something will decide when you finish this marathon swimming career unless you're the one in control of when it finishes. So plan for that, be in control of that, and finish on your terms. And I'd never thought about that before, because I was just so driven, so ambitious, and I would just set goal after goal after goal and always raising that bar. And it took a while. It took like 6 months for that advice to set in. So right now I'd like to be the greatest English Channel swimmer of all time and have the most channel crossings ever. So I'm 7 crossings away from that. That's my next major goal. And after that, I think my goals will just be more for fun, if I can use that word, because that'll still be challenging, but I'm not sure if I'll be going after world records after that. So even just fitting 7 swims in next year in the English Channel, because there's only about a 3.5 month window when you can do them. It's not like I've got the whole year to do it. That's going to be a huge challenge. And then after that, I think I'll take the breaks off. Although if someone challenges my world record for longest non-stop swim, I might feel the urge to come out of retirement if I'm retired and defend that, because that's my special thing. I really like that. So I'm not going to say never, but I'm definitely going to think about winding down in the next couple of years.
You absolutely have to go listen to that entire podcast. Not surprisingly, one of the most listened to podcasts of the third season. You got to go out on Facebook and find her there. She's most active there under her name, Chloe McCardo. Go there and you'll find her on Facebook. And for you swimmers, she's a coach. She runs programs, coaching programs. So check her out. Check out some of her coaching programs too. And we're going to see more of her and her online presence. So watch out for Chloe McCardo. And I can't wait till she goes and, you know, becomes the greatest English Channel swimmer of all time. That would be pretty amazing. She has a very interesting story, and I told her on the podcast, man, you should write a book, you should do a documentary. I can't wait till that comes out. But she's very outspoken about her issue with having become a victim of domestic violence in her journey to overcome it. She was very forward about that on the podcast, and she's open about being a worldwide advocate for combating domestic violence. And I'm hopeful to have her on the podcast again at some point in time in the future. I would love to hear her story, if she'd be willing to talk about it. Sounds like she is willing to talk about it. And I think she will end up being a very powerful force in endurance sport, but also just in general, helping people make big transformations in life, conquering big endeavors in life. I think many of you endurance enthusiasts will see a lot of yourself in her. I certainly saw a lot of myself in her, especially when she talked about constantly trying to shoot for the next big thing. And you complete one endeavor and you want something else, something bigger. You feel like you constantly have to one-up your previous big endeavor. And she talked about, you know, essentially the conclusion that I came to. You really have to decide that you are going to stop doing that at some point in your life, and you have to do it on your own terms. I think many of us that have done these big endurance events for many years and many decades, you get to that point. And for me, I knew when that point came about, and I decided that I wanted to live vicariously through other people and train and coach, build a coaching company, and train the next generation of coaches to work with me to bring about the next generation of endurance athletes. And it seems like she's on that pathway, same exact pathway now, and she's becoming a real force in swim coaching. She also got me thinking about swimming the English Channel. I mean, I never thought about doing it, but she actually implanted the thought in my head. I said, wow, that actually would be a cool thing to do once. So who knows? Maybe you might see me out there trying to do that one day. We'll see. All right, let's go into the last clip. In episode 28, I had a conversation with Dr. Alan Lim. He's a sports physiologist, a cycling coach, and founder of Scratch Labs. And when he wasn't training pro cyclists, he was lending his experience to Saris and was instrumental in their product development of power meters and indoor cycling trainers. He was also director of sports science for Garmin and Radio Shack cycling teams. And this was a great conversation. He is very well known in sports science, so it wasn't surprising that this was one of the top five most downloaded and played podcasts. So we talked a lot about cycling. We talked a lot about the trend of indoor cycling in this age of having to be in isolation. And as everyone's buying a Peloton bike or trying to find different ways of staying indoors in their own isolation and trying to keep their fitness up. So I get his perspective on whether or not he thinks that that trend will continue. So I recommend listening to that podcast. But the clip that I chose is the one where we discussed bikes, and I get his perspective on whether or not he thinks the so-called super bikes are worth the exorbitant fees that cyclists and triathletes are paying for them. You're one of the biggest bike gurus, cycling coaches out there, and so a lot of people probably want to know about your thoughts on the changing of these bikes. I mean, I saw one report in early 2020 saying that the average cost of a triathlon bike increased by $1,500. I don't know if it's if it's true or not, but these new triathlons, quote unquote, super bikes are coming out, and many of them having no seat post, electronic shifters, disc brakes. So all this stuff is happening. What are your thoughts? Is it worth it? And is it worth it for the average weekend warrior doing a handful of events a year? Is it worth it for the professional? What do you fall on these new quote unquote super bikes?
Yeah. Here's where I fall. You know, I'm a middle-aged dude. I'm holding on to the glory years as much as possible.
Me too.
I want it. I do not need it. And that's important. I want it. I do not need it.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, I don't think worth the money at all. The marginal gain that you will get will never change, you know, other factors like getting more sleep or training a little more efficiently, or, you know, managing the stress in your work and your relationships, right? There are way other
there's so much lower hanging fruit in order to go with speed. I do think that the technology trickles down, which is cool. And so there's even less difference today because of how good this tech is between the $10,000 bicycle and the $2,000 bicycle. The $2,000 bicycle of today was the most was the best bicycle, you know, 4 years ago.
Right.
So I think that if we can excuse ourselves from the sense of relative deprivation that marketing creates, we can be better, right? And relative deprivation being the idea that all of your needs are met, but relative to somebody else, you feel deprived because they have the Tesla and you don't. You've got the Nissan, right? And you're just like, oh my gosh, I feel sick now. I feel deprived. And from a psychosomatic standpoint, that's real illness, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the illness of our modern society is that we do practice more want, including myself, than gratitude.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you 100%. You're like in my mind walking around. Because especially the triathletes, you tell triathletes that something will make them faster. They will, money will burn holes in their pocket. They'll go out and get it.
Yeah.
And and the manufacturers will tell you, oh, this will save you X watts, this will save you X watts, this will save you X watts. You add it all up and you're like, wow, I don't even have to pedal. Look at that.
Yeah. You know, it was funny. I was talking to James Swang. He's a bike reviewer for Cycling Tips. And we were talking about the Specialized S-Works line, Harbin versus their Pro line, the 12R versus the 10 or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And he said something really profound. He said, look, man, there's going to be no difference in terms of what you feel between these two bicycles. But if you don't get the S-Works, it's going to bother you.
Yeah.
I was like, ah, crud, man. Like, you're right. Like, I'm as susceptible to it as anyone. It's like, I'm not going to know the difference. I'm going to feel just as much joy and pleasure, but it's going to bother me. And how do I get it to not bother me? I don't know. Maybe I need to find better ways to be fulfilled in life. And that's a very human struggle across our lives.
That is Dr. Alan Lim. I highly recommend you go follow him on Twitter. He's on Twitter as Alan Scratch. That's Scratch, S-K-R-A-T-C-H. And that's the name of his company, by the way, Scratch Labs. They make unbelievable nutrition and recovery product for you endurance enthusiasts. So check him out online. And he also has an Instagram presence. So that was a great clip. I have to play that clip every time I have to talk down a client or triathlete who is looking to just simply throw money at their problems and go out and get a $10,000 bike on a credit card. Remember, the most important piece of equipment is your body. So like Dr. Lim said, there's so many more things that you can focus on versus going out and trying to buy some bike that literally costs more than a motorcycle and that you will be paying off for the next 10 years because you wanted to keep up with your buddy who takes cool pictures on his bikes. So definitely listen to the podcast with Dr. Alan Lim. And with that, we have come to the end of the best of season 3, the most downloaded and played podcasts. Honorable mentions to some of the other podcasts out there that were also really high up on the list. My conversation with CEO of USA Triathlon, Rocky Harris, that one was high up. My conversation with by the way, that was episode 22. Also, my conversation with Maurice Ashley, chess grandmaster. That was also really high up. That was episode 24.
and also my conversation with Mike Riley, the voice of Iron Man. That was also really high up in the downloads. That was episode 25. And that concludes season 3. There are more and more podcasts every day. The last time I looked at the statistics, Apple was saying that there were 500 new podcasts a day. The Endurance Experience has listeners in just about every major country on the planet now. Tens of thousands of listeners. But obviously there is increasing competition for the attention of listeners every day. And so I have some ideas for next season to diversify the listener base, bring more people under our tent. I'm thinking of doing live recorded podcasts, perhaps live on the social media platform. And I'm thinking about doing a coach cast where I get a series of episodes just focused on training and nutrition with a few of my coaching collaborators. So I'll take a break in order to prepare for season 4. In the interim, if you have any suggestions about guests or topics, you can email them at contact@eventhorizon.tv, or you can always go to our private Facebook group, which is Endurance Enthusiasts. Thank you, and this has been season 3 of the Endurance Experience.
Follow Event Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services, to become a member of our Endurance Institute, or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun: Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.